It is our great honor today to talk with the guest conductor on this program, one of the foremost musicians of our time, William Steinberg. Mr. Steinberg, it is my understanding that you are not particularly fond of interviews, whether live, in the paper, or for the radio. May I ask why this is so?
Who told you so?
It's just an unconfirmed rumor. Would you confirm it?
No, I will not confirm it. If it comes to interviews for radio, for newspapers, for television, whatever it might be, if it is about a subject which interests me, for instance, myself, then I'm all for it and I say what I have to say. And I tell all my lies, which I am used to tell now since so many years that I'm in public life.
Well, I hope we have time for all of them. That's the custom nowadays, anyhow, to tell as many lies as possible.
Takes weeks.
I recall an interview with your notable colleague from Philadelphia who complained in advance that he had been misquoted so often, so we had to reassure him that what he said on tape couldn't possibly be altered against him, so he was mollified. Your career, Mr. Steinberg, is a very long and distinguished one, actually spanning half a century. If you look at it from a kind of 34,000-foot altitude, what would you say were some of the really outstanding landmarks?
First of all, I'm glad that out of this altitude I cannot recognize it.
It's all too small down below.
Because it's too small down below. What would I say? That it sometimes went faster than I wished, and that sometimes it went slower than I wished to go. But it seems to me that these ups and downs in musicians' careers, let me say in careers in general, are so habitual that it's hardly necessary to talk about. Anyhow, what I reached, if I may go so far as to say this, I reached through brackets, good luck, bracket closed, and myself, and which is something which in my career does not happen too frequently, because too many are standing in the background, if you want, so in the foreground, to help, shooting, destroying, fostering, whatever it might be. But in my case, I did it all myself.
As we now observe the 25th anniversary of the State of Israel, for example, it must be moving for you to recall that you were one of the founders of the Israel Philharmonic.
That was co-founders.
Co-founders
I
with
do this
Kuberman.
With Kuberman. I underline this because he is one of those famous misquotations which you related to a few seconds ago. I am the co-founder of the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, or better called Palestine Orchestra at the beginning. And in order to make this clear, I want to say that Huberman conceived the idea, Huberman collected the money, and I did the job. This is the clearest way I can put it.
This was in the 1930s, before the state was founded, yes.
1936, very clearly.
And after it became a state, it was renamed the Israel Philharmonic, is that correct?
Yes.
And you have been back to conduct there, I'm sure, quite often.
Not quite often, a few times. I'm just about, or better to say, to make it very clear, in 1974, to go there for a number of concerts. First of all, out of old love for the country. It's a matter of time in my case, because you may not forget, if one is in Israel, it costs you quite a number of weeks, which I usually don't have. Not to speak about the fact that the length of activity is dictated by the number of concerts which you have to conduct. One should not forget, and now I am boasting, and I think rightly so, there's no country in the world where the music enthusiasm shows in every way and also in figures. Because the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra is the only orchestra which can sustain itself, which no other orchestra in the world can do. Secondly, in order to satisfy all the customers, pardon the expression, you have to repeat every program so many times in order to get them all in, that every program, I say now program in quotes, lasts 14 concerts, 11 in Tel Aviv, 2 in Haifa, and 1 in Jerusalem.
It is burnished to a fine glow by the time you get to around number 11.
No, the orchestra really knows it.
Mr. Steinberg, you've had a very long tenure in Pittsburgh since 1952, and also 3 concurrent years as music director in Boston, 1969-72, and you've guest conducted very widely. When you make guest appearances, do you convert an orchestra to your own sound image, or are you more concerned with preserving the one it already has?
No. The idea is that the conductor, if he has something to say, if, large if, he certainly is interested that he puts his stamp on the machine which is at his disposal. Machine man means orchestra. And this is exactly what I am trying to do, that the orchestra sounds after a short while, pardon being so arrogant, like myself. That's it. But arrogance is, after all, one of the trademarks of our profession. Did you ever see a conductor who was so modest as not to assume that this is the case? I don't think so.
I've seen
the word modesty does not appear in the vocabulary of a conductor, any conductor. And that takes the liberty not excluding one.
Well, you know, Adlai Stevenson was once introduced in very flowery language at a meeting. And when he got up to speak, he said, thank you very much. Please remember that flattery is all right as long as you don't inhale. I was very much struck watching you rehearse today, Mr. Steinberg, and to see how a gigantic piece like the Eroica could be led with a minimum of physical effort and gestures. And to me, it was a little bit like turning a key in a fine engine and letting it go, just guiding the direction and the speed. Is this basically your philosophy in conducting a major orchestra?
My philosophy, if you want the word, I think the word philosophy, I'm sorry to say, Mr. Roy, is so frequently misused or abused. If this is my way of conducting an orchestra, I say I try to step into the background as much as I can and let the orchestra do what their due is, certainly under my tutelage, certainly under my guidance, because the orchestra will not do, or I hope will not do, what I do not want. Because that's what I'm there for, that's what I'm paid for, in order to be my own when I'm standing in front of an orchestra. But I try to minimize all external kinds of movements and geratics and what many conductors, young and old, I don't mean only the young one, are doing today. And that an audience is not satisfied if they don't have the pleasure of seeing the crazy man in front of the band dancing and making his ridiculous motions. If you would photograph this, and if you would try to compare it with what actually comes out, you would be surprised how little. And this is one of the reasons why I try to minimize my motions.
You want to keep out of the way of the music between the orchestra and the audience, letting the music do the talking as if you were not.
When I was young and was quick with the pen, not only as impudent with the mouth as I am now, I wrote once an article, it's pretty long ago. I think it was for Musical America. It was at a time when I was still wearing short trousers. A long article which had its title, Don't Disturb, which I think was very fitting, in which I wrote all these things down, in which way an orchestra a conductor is in the way of an orchestra and its playing, technically, spiritually, emotionally, and what all the next nice words might be. And there I put it down. Whether this article is still around, I don't know. I didn't see it for a long while.
I think we can certainly find it. We'll do a little research. When I do find it, I will reprint it, perhaps, in one of our forthcoming programs. Well, we have about a minute left, and can you give an Olympian answer about the future of orchestras? Will they survive the many current crises? Will we have a symphony orchestra a generation from now as we know it today?
Let me quote Igor Stravinsky, whom I once had the audacity to invite to Buffalo to conduct an evening of his compositions. I do remember that in my own presence there was an interview with a newspaper man, and the maestro was asked, "Maestro, what do you think of the future of American symphony orchestras?" Answer, nothing. Question, why? If there are certain corporations, certain bodies, as you see, I do not want to be specific at this moment. I am a guest here and I have to behave like it. If there are certain people around who won't dictate how many rehearsals are necessary to play Sacre du Printemps, as long as this time there is no future for music, for orchestra music. What is the future of music in America? Answer, chamber music.
Well, this doesn't sound terribly hopeful for orchestras, but I have a feeling that perhaps there will be some sense of tradition in seeing what you and your colleagues have done and are still doing that will keep orchestras in the forefront of our consciousness.
You must permit me that I quote Pittsburgh, where I'm coming from, where, with the help of what we achieved, pardon me for being so modest again, and the enormous attraction of our new beauty called Heinz Hall, the attendance number has risen so enormously that we have, from this year on, instead of 2 concerts a week, 3 concerts a week. If you consider the size of Pittsburgh and if you consider the size of Cleveland, you must admit that this is an enormous achievement. And this is a proof that it's not all over with symphony concerts.
Although I'm all in favor of chamber music, I think it will have to wait a little longer for total predominance.
No, why should not both be side by side?
That's peaceful coexistence.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm all for it. Our time, unfortunately, has run out. We could easily spend an hour together exploring the world of music. We are very grateful to William Steinberg for allowing us this time for a conversation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roy. It was my pleasure.